Girin did, and about a minute later he said he thought it was a small conning tower. It seemed to be converging on the Antares's course, as though planning to fall in behind the barge. At this point, the Navy patrol bomber began circling overhead. Geppner needed no further convincing. "Captain, come out on the bridge," he shouted. Outerbridge jumped from his cot in the chart room, pulled on a Japanese kimono, and joined the others. He took one look and sounded general quarters. It was just 6:40 a.m. Seaman Sidney Noble stumbled out of his bunk in the forecastle for the second time in 3 hours, so sleepy he could barely wipe the sand from his eyes. He pulled on dungarees, shoes but no socks, and a blue shirt which he didn't bother to button. Then he joined the other men racing up the ladder to their battle stations. Gunner's mate Lewis Gurner stayed below long enough to slam and dog the hatch leading to the anchor engine room, then dashed after the rest. As he ran aft toward his station in the after well deck, Outerbridge leaned over the bridge railing and frantically waved him away from number one gun, which was now swinging out, trained on the conning tower ahead. Along the after deck, Ensign D.B. Haney ran past number two, three, and four guns, shouting to the men to break out the ammunition. He might have spared himself the trouble at number three. Seaman Ambrose Domagal, the first loader, had been on duty as bridge messenger. As soon as general quarters sounded, he went directly to the gun, yanked open the ready rack, and was waiting with a 3-inch shell in his arms when the rest of the crew rushed up. Outerbridge had signaled all engines ahead full, and the old ward was now surging forward, bounding from 5 to 10 to 25 knots in 5 minutes. "Come left," he called to helmsman Rainbig, and the 1918 hull wheezed with the strain as she heeled hard to port. Outerbridge headed her straight for the gap between the barge and the conning tower, now some 400 yards off the ward's starboard bow. At this point, the Antares caught on. Her blinker flashed the news that she thought she was being followed. Up above, the PBY dropped 2 smoke pots to mark the sub's position. To Ensign William Tanner, pilot of the PBY, this was simply the act of a good Samaritan. He had been on the regular morning patrol when he first spotted the submarine. It was well out of the designated area for friendly subs. His immediate reaction, "My God, a sub in distress." Then he saw the ward steaming in that direction. Quickly he swooped down and dropped his 2 smoke bombs. They would help the ward come to the rescue. From his position, this was the best he could do for the sub. The ward didn't need any markers. The submarine was just to starboard, pointing straight at the ship. It was running awash with the conning tower about 2 feet out of water. In the choppy sea, the men caught brief glimpses of a small cigar-shaped hull. They were utterly fascinated. Chief Commissary Steward H.A. Minter noticed that it was painted a dingy green. Quartermaster Girin saw a layer of small barnacles. Helmsman Rainbig noticed moss on the conning tower. Most of the men thought it looked rather rusty. Everyone agreed there were no markings on the squat, oval conning tower. Curiously enough, the sub didn't seem to see the ward at all. It just kept moving ahead, trailing the Antares at about 8 or 9 knots. "Commence firing," Outerbridge ordered. They were now only 100 yards away, and bosun's mate A. Art, captain of number one gun, knew they were much too close to use his sights. So he aimed the gun like a squirrel rifle and let her go. It was exactly 6:45 a.m. when this first shot whistled over the conning tower and plunged into the sea beyond. They were better squirrel hunters at number three gun on the galley house roof. Gun Captain Russell Knapp gave his order to fire about 30 seconds later, with the target less than 50 yards away. The shell hit the base of the conning tower, just where it touched the water. The sub staggered but came on. Now it was right alongside, sucked almost against the ship. For an instant it seemed to hang there, long enough to give gunner's mate Lewis Gurner an indelible picture of the glass in its stubby periscope. And then it was behind them, writhing and spinning in the ward's wake. 4 quick whistle blasts told Chief Torpedoman W.C. Maskzewiltz to release his depth charges. 1, 2, 3, 4 rolled off the stern. Huge geysers erupted, and the sub was instantly swallowed in a mountain of foam. Maskzewiltz, who set the pistols at 100 feet, noted with satisfaction that the sub seemed to wade right into the first one. Up in the PBY, Ensign Tanner was doing some soul-searching. Helping the sub might be the decent thing to do, but his orders were very strict. Depth bomb and sink any submarines found in the defensive sea area without authority. Now he looked down, the ward was doing just that. A pang of hesitation, and Tanner made another run. This time he dropped some depth bombs of his own. All these fireworks were watched with mild interest by the men on the tub Kiyosakwa. She loafed about 2 miles away, just off the harbor mouth, still waiting to pick up the Antares' barge. Like everybody else on board, Engineer Blackmore thought it was merely some early morning practice. On the ward, Lieutenant Geppner had a far more harrowing thought. He had the awful feeling that it might be an American sub. Of course, it shouldn't have been there, and of course, it didn't look like anything he had ever seen before. But could there have been a mistake? In the PBY, Ensign Tanner had the same feeling. He and his co-pilot, Ensign Clark Greavy, assured each other that orders were orders. But if Tanner's judgment was wrong, a lot of good that would do. He could see the court-martial now, and he could see himself labeled for the rest of his life as the man who sank the American sub. In a wave of youthful self-pity, he began picturing himself trying to get any job anywhere. As the plane resumed its patrol, he grimly reported the sinking to the Kaneohe Naval Air Station and settled back to await the inevitable end of his career. Only Outerbridge seemed absolutely confident. In fact, he decided that the report radioed at 6:51 a.m. wasn't strong enough. It ran, "Depth-bombed sub operating in defensive sea area." This might imply just a periscope sighting or a sonar contact. Throughout the years, there had been too many spars and whales bombed for headquarters to get overly excited about a message like that. But the ward had seen the sub itself, and that was the all-important point to put over. It was the one hope of stirring up some action instead of the standard verify and repeat. So Outerbridge quickly drafted another message. At 6:53, he again radioed the 14th Naval District headquarters. This time, the report ran, "Attacked, fired on, depth-bombed, and sunk submarine operating in defensive sea area." He felt that "fired on" was the key phrase. Now they would know he used his guns. Now they would know that he at least saw something. Even Outerbridge didn't go all the way. He might have reported this extraordinary encounter in the clear instead of in code, and thus saved a few minutes. He might have used his blinker to signal the harbor control tower. He might have sent the more jolting message that was drafted but ended up crumpled in his file. It began with the words, "Sighted conning tower of strange sub fired 2 rounds at point-blank range." But at least he did something. At least he was willing, when other men were hypnotized by peace, to announce that he had blasted the daylights out of someone. Whoever it wasn't Ensign Sakamaki. At 6:30, he and Inagaki were still trying to correct their boat's trim. It was no easy job. Only one man at a time could wriggle on his stomach along the cramped tunnel that led fore and aft from the control room. They took turns, slithering back and forth, shifting lead ballast, twisting the dials that released the air and filled the tanks with water. It took an hour to get the sub back on an even keel. At last they started off again and even found time for a spot of lunch. They sat facing each other in the tiny control room, munching rice balls and exchanging cups of grape wine. As they finished, they grasped each other's hands and again pledged success. 10 minutes later, Sakamaki, peeking through the periscope, was appalled to see that they were approximately 90 degrees off course. With the gyro compass out of order, he was depending on an auxiliary compass, which he thought would at least show the right directions. Apparently, it was out of order, too. He tried to reset his course with his periscope, but it wasn't much help. Blindly, the sub moved this way and that, always seeming to end up in the wrong direction. His hands grew wet with sweat. It was now about 7 a.m., and Ensign Kazuo Sakamaki was still a long way from the mouth of Pearl Harbor.